From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new documentary Outrage is about the outing of alleged gay politicians who have opposed gay rights. The director, Kirby Dick, says the real subject of his film is hypocrisy. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kirby Dick about why and when he thinks outing is justified. Then we'll talk about the experience of being outed with Dan Gurley. He was the Republican National Committee's field director when he was outed in 2004. He no longer works for the party, and he serves on the board of a gay rights group. He opposes outing. For years, the Republican Party has organized against gay marriage, but now the heartland state of Iowa has legalized it. We'll talk with the architect of the lawsuit which led to the legalization, Camilla Taylor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
That's Larry Craig speaking at a news conference on August 28, 2007, denying police accusations that he had made sexual advances toward an undercover officer in an airport men's room. Days later, amidst increasing GOP criticism, the Republican senator from Idaho announced his resignation. The new documentary, Outrage, begins with the case against Craig. The movie is about the outing of allegedly gay politicians who have opposed gay rights. The interviewees include outed politicians and people who have outed them, like blogger Mike Rogers. My guest is the director, Kirby Dick. He also directed the documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated, an investigation into how the Motion Picture Association of America decides on movie ratings. He says that the real subject of his new documentary, Outrage, is hypocrisy. In terms of trying to out closeted politicians, what were your standards of who was worthy, so to speak, of being dragged out of the closet? Like, if the basis of the film is hypocrisy, like, what raises to the level of hypocrisy that it's worth altering, perhaps ruining, somebody's life and career?
Well, I don't view my film as outing closeted politicians. I really view it, the central thesis of it is reporting on hypocrisy. And so what would make a politician who was closeted also be a hypocrite that'd be worthy of me reporting on? I looked at their voting records. And if their voting records were substantially anti-gay, I think in the case of all the politicians I focused on, they were anywhere between 0 and 25% pro-gay. The rest was anti-gay. And that, to me, over oftentimes a two-decade career was certainly an indication that this was an example of hypocrisy. I mean, millions of Americans, millions of gays and lesbians are harmed. Their rights to marry have been taken away. Their rights to health care. Their rights to adopt, their right to serve in the military. I mean, there's very serious consequences. And I think the consequences of this kind of hypocrisy and dishonesty affects the American political system as a whole. It contorts it. When you have powerful politicians who are living dishonestly like this decade after decade, this is something that's, I think, and practicing this hypocrisy, this is something that needs to be reported on.
So how much original reporting did you do on trying to figure out whether allegations and rumors were true or not? You work closely with Mike Rogers on this, and he's kind of famous for outing or trying to out politicians who he feels have been hypocritical. How much original reporting did you feel like you needed to do to fact check his reporting?
Well, we did a fair amount of original reporting. The gay press has been reporting on this for 20 years, and a lot of this was built on their shoulders. In fact, it is the gay press who has been wanting this information out there because they see the cost of the closet, both politically and personally. It's the mainstream press that I find that's been very reluctant to report on this. So what I did is I followed what Mike Rogers did, and I should say that Mike Rogers is someone who actually has been very careful on his reporting. He reported the outing of Larry Craig. He outed Larry Craig 9 months before the news of his arrest in the Minneapolis bathroom was made public. And at the time that he outed Larry Craig, a lot of people were very reluctant to believe him, and it turned out he was true. But Mike Rogers has been very careful in his reporting. And we had very high standards. I mean, we would over the course of 2-3 years that we made this film, we had a team of researchers, and we made sure that all our sourcing was very, very accurate.
I have a confession to make. I mean, I find it really awkward to talk about this. And so I feel like there's an elephant in the room. Let's just put it on the table and talk about it. I think, you know, that what you're trying to do is really interesting, is take politicians who you think have been really hypocritical and very harmful to gay people by voting against the, you know, gay marriage, gay adoption, earlier on not having sufficiently, adequately funded the AIDS crisis, you know, to find medications, possibly vaccines, and so on. And so your goal is to out gay people who are voting against the interests of gays because they're in the closet and they're afraid to come out. So, I think what you're saying is because they're in the closet, they cover up in a way by voting against gay people.
Yeah. That's exactly true. I mean, in many cases, I believe these politicians would, if they were out, would vote pro-gay. So this is what the closet is doing, is causing them a vote against their belief and also against gays and lesbians.
Good. So that's not the elephant. Let's get the elephant on
the
table.
Fair enough. I was waiting for the elephant.
Here comes the elephant. Okay. So the elephant is that I understand what you're doing and I understand why you're doing it. And the film is very interesting. And at the same time, I'm really reluctant to name the names that you name. Because, you know, as a journalist and as the host and co-executive producer of the show, I feel uncomfortable taking responsibility for putting these names on the table because I feel like I can't fact check the work that you've done. I'm not ready to out these people, and I can't be sure that everything that you have. I'm not accusing you of bad journalism, but there's a level of responsibility I feel like I'd be taking when I name the names that you've named.
I understand.
So it just makes it really awkward to talk about the movie.
Well, again, I think the reason that you're concerned is that the mainstream media itself, as a whole, has not covered this issue. In fact, one of the things that I was very surprised by is that when I started screening this film to small groups of audiences, how surprised they were by this information. Not only, you know, which people were closeted and hypocrites, but the fact that this was an issue at all, because the mainstream media has completely, or I won't say completely, but in large part stayed away from this. And that's why the information that you're looking for, that you would like to have as backup, it doesn't exist in the mainstream media. It does exist in the gay press and in the alternative media. That does exist.
Wait, what does exist?
This information, this corroboration that you're looking for. But it does not exist in the mainstream media. And you know, coming, say, somewhat new to this subject here, I understand the discomfort, but that's one of the things I hope that this film does, is I hope that by coming out, it will start a discussion about this. It will bring the mainstream media to this, and these issues will be discussed, these issues will be investigated, and it will no longer seem like this subject matter is coming out of the blue.
You talked to a few people in the film who were outed for this reason of hypocrisy. They were outed by people who are devoting their lives to to outing gay politicians. Did you meet any people who you think their lives were changed for the better by being outed?
I think, absolutely. I mean, I interviewed former Congressman Jim Colby of Arizona, and his story was he was closeted until 1996. He voted against the Defense of Marriage Act, which restricted the rights of gays and lesbians to marry. And as a result, the advocate who knew that he was gay, there were discussions that it was going to come forward with an article and out him. And so he's opposed to outing, but he made the decision, I'm going to step forward and I'm going to beat them to the punch and I'm going to come out and, you know, tell the world that I'm gay. And he describes that experience of coming out as one of the most important experiences of his life, almost a near religious experience. And you can imagine the weight of this secret that he's kept and had to worry about for so many years is suddenly lifted off of him. And Jim McGreevy as well has a very similar experience, that finally, for the first time, he can be honest with the world and honest with a lot of people that are close to him as well. So, and what happens too is, as you know, with Jim Colby, is when the Federal Marriage Amendment came up, which was an even more restrictive attempt to restrict the rights of gays and lesbians to marry, he was a very vocal opponent to it. So what happens is, once people are out of the closet, they don't have anything to protect in terms of their secret, and then they can vote for gay rights.
So with Colby, was he shunned by his party after he came out? Because the party has been so anti-gay in its platform.
Right. Well, what happened was actually, I think it was at the 2000 Republican convention, he was invited to speak not on gay issues, I think it was on trade.
And did we say he's a congressman from Arizona?
He's a congressman from Arizona, and he was invited to speak, and that was very important moment in the Republican Party, an out gay Republican speaking at the national convention. Well, the Texas delegation stood up and turned their back on him. So, and that, you know, I think in some ways was the beginning of what we saw is the George W. Bush legacy of attacking gays and lesbians for their own political gain.
You know, I often wonder, with closeted gay politicians who are voting against gay rights, whether they're doing it to, like, cover up for the fact that they're gay, or whether they're so guilty and conflicted about being gay. And if sometimes the same thing that explains why they're in the closet, that they were brought up, you know, in a way where they truly believe that being gay is evil. And so that maybe they actually somehow truly believe that gay marriage is bad, just as they believe they're bad for having this feeling towards people of the same sex.
I think that's true for some. I think that some, I've been told stories where
which doesn't make it any better for gay people who are getting voted against.
No,
but no. I just wonder about that. You
no,
know?
No. I mean, in my interviews, I've been told stories where of people who would have of a man who would have sex with another man, and then immediately afterward, he turned it to his partner and say, "I'm not gay." I mean, the denial was quite incredible. I think there are other politicians, though, who are very skilled at living that double life. I mean, Mark Foley, for example, who lived somewhat of an out life personally, although politically he didn't, I think was and is a person who's very accepting of his own homosexuality. So it really spans the gamut here. And again, this is what made for such interesting material psychologically. So there was such a range of different kinds of approaches to this.
Do you know if any of the closeted gay politicians who were outed changed their voting patterns after being outed?
Actually, yes. Certainly, Mark Foley did. Mark Foley, there was a sort of a small outing of him in the late 90s. And shortly after that, since then, he's had a very positive pro-gay voting record. The same is true with former Congressman Jim Colby of Arizona. Once he came out, his voting record, his pro-gay voting record, was very strong. It's a very common thing because, again, they no longer need to protect the closet. They can, in fact, I think if they voted anti-gay and were gay, a lot of people would say, "What's going on here?" I mean, I know I would. I mean, why is somebody in power voting against who they are? I mean, there'd be something, I think, almost twisted about that. So, but the real reason they do is because that's what they believe, and they finally have the opportunity to vote the way they believe.
So did making this film affect your gaydar?
It did. It did.
Raise your sensitivity level.
It did. It did. I think, I had pretty decent gaydar, living in Los Angeles. But, no, it's much more refined. It's very funny you say that because I find myself identifying people as gay that I know 2 years ago I wouldn't.
What's the secret?
I guess immersion. One of the pleasures of making this film all of my interview subjects, were very experienced and very articulate. But this was also a very important personal issue for them. I mean, and they had lived this life. As I said, many of them had been closeted and many of them had seen the toll of the closet. And they had thought about this. There'd been a meditation. So in many ways, the themes of this film were being handed to me by people who'd thought about them for 20-plus years.
Well, Kirby Dick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kirby Dick is the director of the new documentary Outrage. It opens Friday. Coming up, Dan Gurley talks about what it was like to be outed. He's the former field director of the Republican National Committee. This is Fresh Air. After talking to Kirby Dick about why he thinks it's important to out politicians with anti-gay records, we wanted to talk with someone who had been outed. My guest, Dan Gurley, was the field director of the Republican National Committee when he was outed in 2004 by Mike Rogers on his blog, Blog Active, which Rogers describes as dedicated to telling the truth about hypocrisy in government. Rogers said Gurley had ultimate authority over an anti-gay flyer sent out by the RNC. Gurley now lives in North Carolina. He works with a nonprofit policy organization and serves on the board of the North Carolina gay rights group, NC Equality. He's one of the people featured in Kirby Dick's documentary, Outrage. Here's an excerpt of the documentary in which blogger Mike Rogers describes what he perceives as the positive impact of having outed Gurley.
recently, I get an email. Dan Gurley's on the board of North Carolina Equality. And I'm like, what? And I went to the website, I looked at about, and I'm like, this is hot. This is why I started Blog Active. He's an out gay man, and he's proud, and he's on the board of a statewide national gay group. This man is using his skill to secure gay rights. What could be better, and what better effect could I have as an individual?
That's Mike Rogers, and Dan Gurley, he's talking about you. So let me ask you, do you think that your life now justifies Mike Rogers' work outing people?
Well, I think that, first of all, when you discuss outing, that the thing you have to keep in mind is that, like many other areas of public life and private life, this is not clearly a black or white issue. There's lots of gray area. I'm doing what I'm doing now. In my role with Equality North Carolina because I believed it was the right thing to do and not specifically because of the experience that I went through with Rogers or with the blogging. You know, I have been open about my sexuality for many years to many people, my parents, my family, many of the people that I worked with, you know, my professional colleagues, both when I worked on Capitol Hill, some of the people I worked with at the Republican National Committee. So, you know, in one sense, I suppose I was outed on a blog, but it wasn't really big news to most of the people who knew me.
So can you tell us a story of when and how you were outed on the blog?
Sure. Sure. What really launched this whole process was in February of 2004, President Bush announced in a press conference his support of the federal marriage amendment. And so as a way to get back at or to seek retribution towards those that were involved in that, Rogers and others like him started blogging and quote-unquote outing staff members. And so over the course of the months leading into the summer, a number of people that I knew who worked on Capitol Hill became targets of Rogers and others as he posted you know, information about them on the blog. So how it ultimately came about was in, I believe it was in September of that year, I got a phone call, I believe on a Thursday night, from a friend who told me that he had had some contact with Rogers and that I was to be the next person that he wrote about on his blog. And 3 or 4 days later, I believe on a Sunday night, I actually got a phone call at my home from Rogers telling me that he was going to be writing about me the next day and asked me several very pointed questions. First of all, was I gay? Answered that, yes, in fact, I was. And then he questioned me with regards to the Republican National Committee and my work at the committee and wanted to know if I did not have some guilty conscience or other problems with the work that I was doing at the committee and helping to elect, you know, a president and other elected officials who did not support equality. And I made it clear to him at that time that that there were positions that the Republican Party held that I disagreed with, and that I was not at a point where I could discuss those, but that that he had to understand and others had to understand that I and many other people did not walk in lockstep with our political party in every single issue.
Okay, but you were the national field director for the Republican National Committee. Mm-hmm. And at this point, at that point in time, we're talking 2004, the Republican, you know, National Committee was really organizing around gay marriage, around an amendment to outlaw gay marriage. So the fact that their field director was gay, I can't imagine they'd be happy with that.
Well, actually, I think a couple of points I should make there. First of all, when the blogging happened with Rogers, the staff of the Republican National Committee could not have been any more supportive of me. The chairman, the deputy chairman, the political director, all of those that I worked with directly who I gave a heads up to and told them that this was coming were very sympathetic. They understood what was happening. They made it abundantly clear that that I was a welcome part of that organization, and they wanted me to stay there. Now, with regards to what was taking place with the marriage amendment, I think it's important to point out here that while the president had endorsed the marriage amendment early that year, up to that point, he had said virtually nothing about it, and during the, pretty much overall in the campaign, there was very little mentioned on the part of the president about marriage issues. Yes, there was certainly activity in Congress in terms of votes on a federal marriage amendment. There were individual efforts at the state level about, supporting state-level constitutional amendments. And I think you also have to be fair here and point out that it wasn't just the Republicans who were supporting those amendments at the state level. Senator Kerry and Senator Edwards endorsed the marriage amendment that was on the ballot in Missouri at that time.
Dan Gurley will be back in the second half of the show. Gurley is the former field director of the Republican National Committee. He's one of the people interviewed in the new documentary Outrage about the outing of allegedly gay politicians who have opposed gay rights. The film opens Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive Automotive X Prize, a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now, that's progressive. From DKI Witness Travel, publisher of full-color guidebooks that help travelers visualize and plan trips through 3D maps and sample itineraries. And from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dan Gurley talks about the Republican National Committee's anti-gay rights mailing that led to his being outed. And we talk with lawyer Camilla Taylor, the architect of the lawsuit that led to the legalization of gay marriage in Iowa. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the outing of allegedly gay politicians and political operatives who have opposed gay rights. That's the subject of Kirby Dick's documentary, Outrage. One of the people interviewed in the film is Dan Gurley, who was the Republican National Committee's field director when he was outed by blogger Mike Rogers in 2004. Let's get back to our interview with Gurley. The Republican Party, for years, had used homosexuality and the spread of homosexuality as a way to frighten people into voting for Republicans. And you know, the idea was that, you know, homosexuals are out there, they want more rights, and they're scary people. that was the kind of like text or subtext of a lot of campaign literature, and not only of the Republican Party, but of the religious right, which was such an important backer for the Republican Party for years, but particularly like in the Bush-Cheney campaign, they were a huge source of votes and money, and they're like at the top of their agenda was like homosexuals are scary, they sin, now they want to get married, it's going to ruin marriage for everybody else. So like, how did you feel being, you know, if not explicitly, implicitly a part of that by being the field director for the Republican National Committee?
Well, a couple of points I would make here for you, Terry.
Yeah, please.
One is that, first of all, I absolutely disagreed with the position that the Republican Party had on the marriage issue with regards to equal rights for the gay and lesbian community. You know, the unfortunate circumstance, I guess you could say, for folks like myself is that we live in a country where there are two viable political parties. And if there were a third one, I would be a member of that, you know, a political party that was fiscally conservative and socially libertarian. I wish there was, but there isn't. And so ultimately, you know, I and many others had to make decisions on who we were going to, you know, the candidates we were going to support, the campaigns that we would be involved in based on a whole host of factors. You know, I think a good example of that is just this very past election. You look at the fact that, you know, there was a recent CNN poll where 4% of the electorate identified as gay or lesbian and 27% voted for John McCain. It's not that uncommon to have people in both political parties that again are not walking in lockstep or agreeing with every tenet of their party. Now, I personally have qualms about the role of the religious right in Republican Party politics. I think that in many ways, the religious right has certainly captured elements of the Republican Party. They've driven away a lot of the moderates and the you know, the libertarian thinking Republicans that are out there, and I think that's a huge problem that the Republican Party is going to have to deal with in the future.
Now, the movie Outrage, mm-hmm. which is about the outing of gay people in politics, says that when you were with the Republican National Committee as the national field director, the movie says you oversaw mailings that opposed gay marriage or gay rights. Can you tell us what the mailings were that the movie's referring to? Yeah.
The particular piece of mail that seemed to caused a lot of people in the gay community to get angry was a piece of mail targeting voter registration, trying to get people to register Republican. And it only went out in two states. It went out in Arkansas and West Virginia. I first became aware of this one particular piece of mail when it actually showed up on my desk as a proof for me to check to make sure that it had the proper legal disclaimer on it and that there were no typos in it. I had absolutely nothing to do with the targeting of that mail, with the design, the production, the content, anything to do with it until that point. And when I first saw the piece of mail, I knew that it crossed a line.
How did it cross a line? What did it say that crossed a line?
Okay. What it did was there were a couple of scenes in the piece where one showed a picture of a man on his knees proposing to another man, and there was gold letters stamped across it that said "allowed." And then when you turn the page over on the other side, there was a picture of a Bible, and in gold letters stamped across that it said "banned." And so it was clearly an appeal to religious conservatives to vote Republican because Republicans would be better at blocking same-sex marriage than Democrats would be.
So you thought that this literature crossed a line?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was.
So what could you do about it?
Well, that was just it. There was little I could do about it. I raised objections to it internally. I went to my superiors. I told them that that I thought it crossed the line. I thought it was it would come back to bite us, and that it was over the top. And I did that both with the Republican National Committee and with the Bush-Cheney campaign.
And did it go out anyways?
And it went out anyway. Now, you know, at that point, I'm not sure what I could have done. I mean, I was in no position to stop the piece of mail.
I understand that, but there's a part of you that felt like, I don't want to play for this team if this is what they're sending out.
Yeah, there was. There absolutely was. But at that point, you know, what do you do? I raised the objections that I thought were appropriate at that time. And they weren't heeded. The piece of mail was distributed. There was a backlash to it, as I had predicted. Mm-hmm. And because of that backlash, there were additional internal controls placed on the mail programs across the board and from the Republican National Committee. And nothing like that happened again.
One of the premises of outing is that if all the people who were in the closet were out, then we'd look around us and we'd see all of these gay people. Mm-hmm. Our prejudices would be undone because we'd see all these people who we were close to and we assumed were straight are actually gay. People would realize that they can't get their jobs done without the support of the gay people who work with them. Mm-hmm. And it would just not be possible anymore to have some of the same stereotypes that so many people have. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah, I certainly don't disagree with that. I think that the more people who are out and open about who they are, the better off we ultimately all are going to be. And I think that applies not just in the realm of politics and public policy, but I think it appeals to, it's the same regardless of whether you're talking about Hollywood and the entertainment industry or whether you're talking about the factory or the office that you work in. I think the more people there are that are out, the better off ultimately we will be. But at the same time, I think that you also have to take into account, particularly with middle-aged and older individuals, there's very much a generational divide here in that, many of the younger people in this country in their teens, 20s, and 30s are much more accepting of gay and lesbian individuals than are people in their older years. And I think that that's something you have to think about when you're talking about outing. A man or a woman who's in their 60s that may have known their whole life that they were gay simply did not have the options available to them. They were not in a climate where they could do this sort of thing back in the 50s or the 60s or something. It is very much a generational thing. And, they responded as they thought they had to respond at that time. They got married. They had children. They have grandkids today. And, it's inevitable that now you hear stories of, almost daily of people, men and women in their 50s and 60s and even 70s who are just now coming out. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's because of, the public attitudes are changing. But at the same time, I think you have to have at least some understanding of where these people are coming from and what their lives were like when they made the decisions that they made many years ago. And that was one of the points that I brought up and that was so important to me to make in this movie, and it was one of the reasons I agreed to be interviewed for this movie. And I'm thankful that footage of my comments was included at the beginning of the movie, is that, ultimately I do think outing is a process or a thing that can be very harmful to people. I also believe that no one can know or understand the personal journey that an individual takes to accepting their sexuality. And no one, be it either, Mike Rogers or Kirby Dick or anybody else, can be ultimately the decider on that. That can be the arbiter of when it is right and when it is not to come out. And I think that that's important to recognize. Again, I think that, this is just not something that can be clearly defined in black and white terms.
So what impact did outing have on you? As you said, you were already out to some of your colleagues at work. You were out to your mm-hmm. family. You were out to your friends. So it's not like, you know, like some people are so deep in the cause that they haven't admitted to themselves they're gay. You were not in that position.
Not at all.
But there were plenty of people who you work with and plenty of people in the party that you represented who had no clue that you were gay. So mm-hmm. so what was the impact of being outed on Mike Rogers' website?
Okay. All right. Well, the impact was this. First of all, the position that I was in at the Republican National Committee was one that was scheduled to be phased out after the end of the election cycle, and I knew that when I accepted it. The typical pattern would be that as the political parties, the committees downsize after an election, those people would move from campaign positions into positions within the administration. And that would have been the route that I would have gone as well, is leaving the Republican National Committee and being taking a position somewhere in the Bush administration, a policy position, probably at a cabinet agency or something of that nature. I began on that path, working with the Office of Presidential Personnel and going through interviews and such. But ultimately, about, I guess maybe 2 months after I left the committee, month and a half, I got a call telling me that I was no longer going to be considered for a presidential appointment and that I needed to start looking in the private sector. So even though the people that I worked with at the RNC were fully supportive of me at the time and were even vouching for me and serving as references for me to go into the administration, the Office of Presidential Personnel made the decision that they did not want me as a part of the administration. So that certainly was one consequence.
Dan Gurley, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm glad to talk with you too, Terry.
Dan Gurley is the former field director of the Republican National Committee. He's one of the people interviewed in the new documentary Outrage about the outing of allegedly gay politicians who have opposed gay rights. The film opens Friday. Coming up, why Iowa was chosen as a state to focus efforts to legalize gay marriage. We talk with the architect of the successful lawsuit, Camilla Taylor. This is Fresh Air. Gay marriage is now legal in the heartland state of Iowa, and many people think the Iowa State Supreme Court's decision represents a turning point in the movement for marriage equality. My guest, Camilla Taylor, was the architect of the case and its lead lawyer. She's a senior staff attorney in the Midwest Regional Office of Lambda Legal, a legal organization which works for the civil rights of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people. Camilla Taylor, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you think Iowa would be a good place to sue on behalf of the right of gay people to marry?
Well, thanks so much for having me, Terry. We really believed that Iowa could open the door to equality for the Midwest. And in addition to having very strong precedent with respect to liberty and equality and a tradition of independence in the state courts in Iowa, there was also a long and rich tradition of doing the right thing in a number of civil rights struggles that came before us. And just to give you a few examples, Iowa was the first state to admit a woman to the practice of law, and Iowa permitted women to own property. Very early in the 19th century, actually at a time when most other states still considered married women to be property themselves. And Iowa's courts desegregated Iowa's schools almost 100 years before Brown versus Board of Education, and Iowa was one of the first states actually to eliminate its ban on interracial marriage. So we knew we could rely on Iowa's tradition of standing up for what's right, often long before other states. And we also had spoken to a number of couples, you know, dozens of couples, if not more, over a period of years who had been eager for us to bring a lawsuit on their behalf. And all of these couples assured us that they would be treated fairly and with respect, and that we could bring a lawsuit and have it embraced by the people of Iowa.
Was there also like a symbolic function in your mind? Because like Iowa symbolizes the heartland. So if you could win in the heart of the heartland.
I think that's absolutely right. I think in many ways this decision, both that it was unanimous and that it was in the heartland, has been more effective than any other marriage case so far in demonstrating that really it is just the common sense and decent thing to do to strike down discrimination in marriage, and that it's consistent with the most core mainstream American values of fair treatment by government, for example, or commitment to families to end discrimination in marriage and to make sure that everyone is treated equally.
So this was a judicial case. You know, you were suing in the court, so you didn't need, like, the popular vote. You didn't need the legislature. But did you want popular support anyways? Did you lay the groundwork for popular support even though there wasn't going to be a vote?
Absolutely. We think it's actually irresponsible to bring a lawsuit if you are not also doing your homework with respect to building public support for the essence of the lawsuit, for what it is that you're trying to do through the courts. And so it's our obligation, I think, to make sure that we can bring along with us the hearts and minds of the people of the state. And so we had been working in Iowa for years with Iowans on the ground, trying to do grassroots organizing and to start a conversation with people across the state about why it is that it is so very unfair to exclude some families from the protections and the responsibilities of marriage.
What was your most winning argument? What was the argument that you felt had appeal to convince people who weren't already on board about gay marriage?
Well, I think the most effective thing is to have the families who are affected, who are really harmed by the exclusion from marriage, out there talking to their communities. And there were a number of stories that they told that I think really changed people's hearts and minds. And one of those stories was a story that we highlighted in the oral argument before the Iowa Supreme Court, in addition to in our briefing in the case. And this was the story told by a couple from Iowa City, Jen and Don Barbarowski. And they have two beautiful daughters who are now 11 and 8. But when the eldest daughter was preschool age and they were seeking a preschool for her, they interviewed a number of preschool directors and visited a number of places, and they were about ready to put their money down on a place that seemed perfect when they thought to ask the director of the preschool whether their daughter would be treated any differently because she had two moms. And the director of this preschool answered, after thinking about it for a moment, well, she won't be allowed to give a presentation on her family during the unit when all of the children are invited to stand up before the class and talk about their families. So it became clear to them that their daughter would be forced to sit alone listening to stories about families told by every other child in the class. And this was really a demonstration of what happens when you exclude some families from marriage, when you, as a government, as a society, send a message that some families shouldn't be treated equally or they're less deserving of dignity or respect than other families. You hurt the whole family, and the children suffer as much as anyone else.
So when the Iowa Supreme Court handed down its decision, what parts of that decision did you think were most significant in setting the tone or setting a precedent for other states?
Well, I think the decision was significant not just because it was unanimous and issued by a court that included both Republican and Democratic nominees, and not just because it was in the heartland, but because of the substance of the decision as well. And for one thing, Iowa is now the third high court to rule that classifications based on sexual orientation merit heightened scrutiny. And what that means in layperson terms is that when a law singles a group of people out based on their sexual orientation for different treatment, that a court has to look particularly carefully at that classification to see if it's in some way motivated by discrimination. And that's because of the history of discrimination against gay people, and also because we know that sexual orientation doesn't have anything to do with an individual's ability to contribute to society. There were a couple of other things that I think were particularly noteworthy about this decision. One of the things that the court did was to address in very simple terms the argument made by many people that is faith-based. Many people who are people of faith believe that marriage is exclusively between a man and a woman and would like to exclude other people from marriage. And the court pointed out that government has no business interfering in church matters, and that churches will continue to be able to do whatever they have done in the past. They will continue to be able to make their own decisions about whom to marry, that the case concerned only civil marriage, marriage licenses issued by government. And by addressing this argument head on and by talking about the separation between church and state, I think the court made a powerful statement that will be read widely and will be effective in showing that the discussion that takes place among many faith traditions about marriage for same-sex couples is a really distinct discussion that has no place in courtrooms when we're talking about government's obligation to treat people fairly.
My guest is Camilla Taylor, the lead lawyer on the suit that culminated in the legalization of gay marriage in Iowa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Camilla Taylor, the lead lawyer on the suit that ended with the Iowa State Supreme Court's decision to legalize gay marriage. She's a senior staff attorney with Lambda Legal. So you've won for gay and lesbian couples in Iowa the right to legally marry. Does that ensure them equality in marriage nationally?
Well, what we won was a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court that the Iowa Constitution guarantees the right to marry for same-sex couples, which means that under state law, Iowa same-sex couples must be treated equally to different-sex couples. Unfortunately, the federal government still purports to deny any form of legal recognition for relationships between same-sex couples. So what this means is that Iowa couples who marry will still not be able to get any of the thousands of federal rights and responsibilities and protections available to married couples.
Last November, Californians voted for Proposition 8, which basically overturned the right to marry that gays and lesbians had recently won in California. And that seemed like a real setback to the gay rights movement. But subsequent to that, gays have won the right to marry in Iowa and Vermont. So looking back now, how do you see Prop 8 as fitting into your fight to legalize gay marriage?
When Prop 8 passed, it was a really disappointing blow. And we and a number of other legal organizations immediately filed a challenge to Prop 8. We were honored to have the support, in addition, of a number of organizations representing people of color and representing women and many others. And the essence of the challenge is that Prop 8 was not passed with the proper deliberative process that is required when you're going to make such a fundamental change to a state constitution and to California's constitution in particular. We're expecting an answer from the California High Court in this legal challenge by the beginning of June, so we will know whether Prop 8 has been upheld.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners are assuming that you're a lesbian and that's why you care so much about the issue of gay marriage, but you're straight. You're married to a man, and you still care a lot about the issue of gay marriage. So why has this become your cause?
It's true. I am married to a man, a wonderful man. We got married in June of 2005, and we have a daughter who will turn 2 in July. But I wanted to become involved in this movement from the time I was in law school, and it became apparent to me, you know, I have enormous respect for all of the civil rights activists who came before us and the people who fought so hard in the courts and as grassroots activists for rights for people of color and for women. And it became clear to me that it is my social justice movement, too, because I don't want to live in a country in which people are treated unfairly. I don't want to be a person taking advantage of privilege and bias. And so it's, you know, part of that age-old feeling that so many, I guess, members of social justice movements have felt, which is that we're not free until everyone is free. And so it does feel like it is my movement because of my obligation as an American to do something about discrimination, I suppose. I'm not sure how to put it differently.
So how many gay couples in Iowa have gotten married since the state's Supreme Court decision, approximately?
I don't know how many couples at the moment. Marriage has only been available for a little over a week. But on the very first day that marriage was available, the Des Moines Register published an account that suggested about 380 couples around the state had applied for licenses. And there is a 3-day waiting period in Iowa for marriage licenses that applies. So you can begin to get married after those 3 days, but you can get married for a long time after that. So I don't know how many of those couples have actually gotten married at this stage.
So you're getting a lot of invitations to gay weddings?
I have been invited to a couple, and I'm really looking forward to going. I will try not to cry.
Camilla Taylor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
Camilla Taylor was the lead lawyer on the case that resulted in the legalization of gay marriage in Iowa. She's a senior staff attorney in the Midwest Regional Office of Lambda Legal, which advocates for the civil rights of gays and lesbians. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
My name is Sarah Palin, you all know me.
A week before she gave birth last year, Amy Poehler did a hysterical Sarah Palin rap with Palin sitting right next to her. On the next Fresh Air, Poehler talks about her years on Saturday Night Live and her new NBC series, Parks and Recreation. Join us for the next Fresh Air.